It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're in the midst of a new era of fresh dairy. Those local milks that can taste like nectar, the butters that each taste different, the buttermilk made the old way. Those are the signs. Farmers are rolling the dice. Instead of selling their milk to big outfits, they're putting their own mark on their foods, creating craft dairy. It's far more time-consuming than large-scale production, but it can be more delicious. Well, today we talk with a dairy woman who's turned buttermilk into a star. It's not anything like what we get in the supermarket.
The buttermilk in the supermarket is, in fact, skim or low-fat milk to which a culture has been added. Real buttermilk is exactly what it sounds like. It's milk that was left over from the butter churn.
And you can make it yourself. Well, stay with us for lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Buttermilk. Well, that's what you buy for a recipe. You use a cup or so, and a couple of months later, it's still sitting in the fridge. Then you hear people reminiscing about the buttermilk on the farm, the drink everyone couldn't get enough of. Well, where's that buttermilk? It's in Vermont, and it's being made by Diane St. Clair. Diane's famous in food circles for her butter. It's the only one that Chef Thomas Keller will use. Well, now the delicious leftovers of that remarkable butter are going into bottles. And she does this all with merely 10 cows on her animal farm in Orwell, Vermont. Well, Diane's written the Animal Farm Buttermilk Cookbook. Diane, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Really? Only 10 cows?
Really only 10 cows, Lynn. But I started with two, so now I figure I'm a big farm.
But seriously, I can imagine that the demand for your products is huge. Why not more than 10 cows?
Well, you know, I got into farming because I love cows, and I wanted to be a farmer and a butter maker. And I think that if I got much larger, I would have to give one of those things up. The thing that usually goes is the milking, which I do at either end of the day, and I'm in my creamery during the day. But milking is an essential part of what I do because it's the time I get to check in with the cows, see how they're feeling, see what they're up to, give them a scratch. It's what I love, and I wouldn't want to do my job without it. So if I get too big, I can't do that.
Yeah, you said something at one point I read that if you get to the point where you forget their names, it's too many cows.
Exactly. I have to be able to just reel off their names. And, you know, I think maybe after 10 or 11, I have to say 11 because I have one coming up, I won't be able to do that anymore. I'm getting older.
Well, yeah. But as long as the cows don't know about it, it's great.
Exactly.
So how is your buttermilk different from the buttermilk that we get in the supermarket?
I think that most people don't realize that the buttermilk they get in the supermarket is, in fact, skim or low-fat milk to which a culture has been added. Real buttermilk is exactly what it sounds like. It's milk that was left over from the butter churn. And sadly, in our days of, you know, mass production of dairy foods, that's been lost. What I'm making on my farm is coming out of my churn. So that means that it started with cream, right, not with low-fat milk. And so I make a cultured butter. So I put a cultured cream in my churn. And then when the churning is done, what I have left is butter and this wonderful, creamy, tangy buttermilk, which is the real deal.
What does the culture do to the cream?
The culture acidifies it, basically. It's putting a lactobacillus culture in. It's fermenting it, for lack of a better word. And that makes it easier to churn. But also, I start with essentially a creme fraiche product. That's what's going into my churn. Uh-huh. And so the buttermilk that's left over is very clabbered and creamy and has flecks of butter in it. It's absolutely amazing. And I think probably approximates what happened on farms 100 years ago when everybody made butter on the farm.
And these are the, you know, you hear people reminiscing even more from more recent times, fabulous buttermilk. They couldn't wait to drink it. And
yes,
I think
delicious.
We rarely feel that way about the stuff we get in the supermarket.
Yeah, I think of people, you know, I was talking to somebody when I was on my book tour in Charleston. She was lamenting how you used to see buttermilk all over the South and it's gone. And I think it's because pre-refrigeration, people kept milk around and it clabbered. It fermented. This is very common in warm cultures. They have some kind of clabbered milk. And that was delicious to drink. But then when it became commercialized and you were just working with skim milk, a lot of the taste was lost and people didn't like drinking it as much.
Okay. What do you do with this wonderful milk?
Well, I wrote the book because I decided that buttermilk isn't just for breakfast anymore. I mean, everybody knows, oh, it's fabulous in waffles and pancakes, and it makes things rise miraculously. But in fact, you can do lots of things with it. I think that one thing is that people are intimidated to cook with buttermilk. And one reason for that is it can do what we call the break. If you heat it too harshly, if you take it to a boiling point, mm-hmm. if you're not slow and steady with it, it can break. But that break will often come back, and you can then put that back into your sauce, and it will melt back down. But in my book, I talk about how not to be intimidated by this, to cook slow and easy, not to add any extra acid. And another secret thing is to maybe put some flour in it. For instance, you can make a fabulous bechamel sauce with buttermilk, and it won't break because you've got that flour in there.
Oh, that would have such a delicious tang to it.
Yes, and you know how sometimes cream or milk can kind of make it a little gluey and flat, but the buttermilk gives it this wonderful acidity and a lightness, and it's great in lasagna. I use it as a white sauce on pizza. It really adds another dimension of flavor.
So can we make buttermilk ourselves?
Yes, and I encourage people to do this. What's important is to try to source an excellent cream, because the fresher and better the cream, the better your buttermilk will be. And then you also need to, if you can find a buttermilk that has a live culture, that's what you need. You're going to take that cream and heat it very gently to about 70 degrees using a thermometer.
Uh-huh.
Take it off. What I like to do is put it in a yoga therm because...
Well, what's a yoga therm?
Oh, it's a wonderful little device that will hold about a quart of fluid milk, but it's surrounded by styrofoam so that it will keep that temperature stable.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to add, let's say you've got 4 cups of cream, a cup of buttermilk with a live culture, and just keep it at that temperature overnight, stick the yoga therm top back on it,
uh-huh.
and then in the morning you'll have this nice, thick product. It will be like a creme fraiche or a thick yogurt consistency. You put it in a food processor, and in 3 or 4 minutes, you're going to have butter and buttermilk. You're then going to run that through a sieve, save your buttermilk like the precious gold that it is, and then you're going to take that butter and put it on a slab, you know, some kind of cool slab, and wash it so that you get all of the milky substance out of it. You know, fold it over, wash it. And then it's going to keep for a couple of weeks in the refrigerator and will be delicious butter.
Now we know what Thomas Keller has been getting. We just need your cows, that's all.
Well, that's the thing. You should find some nice Jersey cream. That's what you want to do.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Diane.
It's been a pleasure.
Diane St. Clair and her Jersey cows live on Animal Farm in Orwell, Vermont. Diane's book is The Animal Farm Buttermilk Cookbook. Now, one way of using your homemade buttermilk is with a recipe for Indian buttermilk soup. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Eating for a living. Now that's tracking down exceptional food. Well, it looks great from the outside, but somewhere around your fourth lousy meal in 2 days, the glamour wears off. But the road food experts, Jane and Michael Stern, never give up. They always come in with prime finds. Hey, you two. Welcome back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
What's the latest?
We have been eating sandwiches. You know, we love sandwiches, but in particular, what we love are the sandwiches on long hero rolls, grinder rolls, whatever you want to call them. And, you know, all around the country, there are different versions. There are heroes, hoagies, grinders, wedges, zeps, po'boys, and, you know,
submarines. Don't forget submarines.
And submarines, of course. Now, the place that claims to have invented the submarine sandwich is the White House in Atlantic City, which I think serves some of the very best, if not the best in the country. One of the reasons they're so good is that the White House is directly across the street from Formica Bakery. And they get their bread for these sandwiches delivered 6 times a day. So it is as fresh as it could possibly be.
This sounds like Paris, where the baguettes are baked every hour.
It is, except the sandwich is not that Parisian. They have all kinds of hot and cold ones. The best is what they call the White House Special, which is, you know, capicola, cheeses, and
pasto on bread.
They have a way of arranging these meats in the bread so that they're kind of fluffed up. It's not too dense. It's not too fluffy. It's just sort of perfectly arranged. A little oil, vinegar, spices. It is the ultimate Delaware Valley hero sandwich.
Okay, where else is there a stellar sandwich?
Well, we must talk about New Orleans and the po' boys there. Now, of course, all know about oyster po' boys, shrimp po' boys, catfish po' boys, and they're fantastic down there. But what we didn't realize until fairly recently is that New Orleans is also a bastion of fantastic roast beef po' boys, because what you get in these is not just roast beef, but it's more like pot roast, along with gravy. And in that gravy is plenty of what they call debris. In other words, all those scraps from the cutting board. So, in fact, there are some places like the Parkway Bakery where you can get simply a gravy sandwich. Now, it sounds kind of Spartan. It isn't, because the gravy contains so many scraps of meat that it is a kind of a full-fledged meaty sandwich in and of itself.
Is this like taking all the pan drippings from when you've roasted beef?
Yes,
all the
absolutely.
That's exactly what it is.
And I think Mother's is one of the
Mother's
more
makes
famous,
another good one, yes.
Yeah, a debris sandwich.
Now, we have to talk about Philadelphia, do we not? And, of course, everyone knows about Philly cheesesteaks. The somewhat lesser known but equally fantastic Philadelphia sandwich is the roast pork sandwich, which is similarly configured, preferably without the cheese, but possibly with sautéed spinach with a lot of garlic, with freshly roasted pork. I mean, how great is that?
And, Michael, what about the West Coast Philippe's, the original with the French dip sandwich?
That used to be a unique regional specialty of Southern California. Now the French dip is pretty much everywhere.
But it's there at Philippe's, it is especially
great.
Wonderful.
And always served with that strange non-noun au jus.
Okay, but you better explain exactly what a French dip is, because I really think that this may not be known across the country.
Okay, a French dip is a roast beef hero or po' boy, but what makes it different is that the bread itself gets dunked in natural gravy. So that's it's kind of a very juicy sandwich, and even the bread itself becomes slightly juicy.
And you do the dipping yourself, don't you?
Well, they will provide you a cup of au jus along with it, or they will dip it. And the essential condiment for one of these is roaring hot mustard, which Felipe's makes.
Okay, so we've got a great quartet going here.
Yes.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. You can find their columns in Savoir magazine. For their latest dining picks, check out the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of our projects, podcasts, our giant recipe box, and our books, including our new collection of ebooks, Eating In. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Now we're going to be back with the compelling question, how did the land of the hot dog, that's us, become the land of sushi on every corner? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Daniel Klein and Mira Fine are living the dream, at least a dream to many of us. They're circling the world, seeking out people who work with food in all sorts of ways. Daniel's the chef with serious restaurant chops. Mira's the writer and designer who knows how to handle a camera. And their site is perennialplate.com. Mira, Daniel, good to have you guys back.
So good
Thanks
to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So what's one of the stories that you've picked up? I know you've been in Italy, and as you know, I have a certain partiality to that country, but what are some of the things you found?
Well, it was really hard to decide what to focus on in Italy because there's so many amazing things going on there. And we found this story of a pasta maker in Tuscany, and it's funny because we actually first heard this story while filming in a remote village in India, where there was this Italian girl who was woofing in the farm that we were filming. And we said, hey, we're going to Italy. Who should we film? Who has a good story? And she said, you have to meet Franco Pedrini and his three sons who grow wheat and make their own pasta. They're amazing. And this actually sounded really great for us because we had already scheduled a story to go hunting for truffles in Marche, Italy. And so we figured, okay, showing up to a pasta maker's home with a bag full of truffles could really work out well for us.
The doors were going to open immediately. Yeah. Yeah.
But it sort of worked out. So we had our truffles. We'd gone out and found the bianchettos, the ones that are kind of in between seasons, and went to this biodynamic farm and found out shortly before that our translator had canceled. So we don't speak Italian, unfortunately. So we show up at these people's house and proceed to have a truffle lunch of their pasta with very few language skills. It was really, really good, actually, for us because we were able to develop this broken small talk and become friends. And then the next day, actually, their son, who speaks English, came, and then we were able to do the interviews and already be pals.
So tell me about this. They're growing the wheat and they're making the pasta. Is this a family tradition?
No, you know, the interesting thing about Franco is that he, up until 20 years ago, was a Phi Ed teacher up in the mountains. And he just decided when his kids were, you know, 10, 12, and 8, that he was going to pick the family up and become a farmer. He knew nothing about farming. He didn't know about how to make pasta. He just decided to try his hand at it, go back to the land, as they say.
He had a passion for organic and for a natural way of life. He was seeing, like so many people, I think, these days, that we've been using these bleached flours. Everyone's using the same ones. And he really wanted to get back to these old grains that he had seen. And so he started researching and finding these beautiful heirloom wheats, heirloom semolinas, all these different things, and planting them and trying to find a way to make good pasta out of them. So over the course of 20 years, he's been refining his craft.
What's the name of the brand of pasta?
San Cristoforo.
Is it available in the United States?
It is not available in the United States. They've actually had quite a number of people in the United States reach out to them to try to do it, but they would have to increase their amount so dramatically that it would make it difficult for them to continue in the style that they want to. So they have to do it slowly. They do want to get to that point, but it needs to be a progress.
So, I mean, he had to have a hard row to hoe in the beginning, I would imagine.
He did because he didn't have a farming background, and he had to find land in the Tuscany area. So, I mean, he rents this land, and he's been renting it for 20 years, and now they're at risk of losing the land, which is also a difficult thing.
Well, I think 20 years ago, Tuscany, it was a different place than it is today.
It's true.
You know, it's such a, there are so many tourists, so many people coming to visit.
Right.
It's so,
right.
You know, it's sort of beautiful there with all the olive trees and the vineyards that it's just kind of another example of someone being pushed out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Because the land becomes so valuable.
Because
it, you know. In terms of real estate. Yeah. You know, I understand that, speaking of beautiful old farmhouses, that you went to see the making of my favorite all-time cheese, Parmigiano Reggiano. But I understand that in addition to that, something happened. Okay, come on, tell the story, okay?
Okay, I have to preface it by saying that we, you know, we came to Italy with the purpose of filming all these stories, but also the overall, you know, we're going to create an overall montage video that is 10 things we love about Italy. So we filmed balsamic vinegar production in some woman's attic. We filmed a prosciutto producer, all these things. The last thing we filmed was a small family-owned Parmesan cheese producer. And so this guy was showing us how he made the cheese, and he was wearing these, you know, full chest-high rubber overalls. He was very cute. And then after about maybe an hour, Daniel was like, I think we should go into the cheese cave and now film in the cheese cave, which is like this beautiful, you know, tall-ceilinged room with wheels of Parmesan cheese from the floor to the ceiling. It was just really, really beautiful and freezing cold. And Daniel said, okay, before we start, I would really like to take a picture of us in here, so I'm going to set up the camera. And I thought, oh, that's such a great idea because this is such a beautiful space.
So I have Mira reach into our camera backpack and pull out a ring. We met in a cheese shop. I thought it appropriate to get engaged in the place where the king of the cheeses is made. And she said yes.
So romantic. Congratulations, you two.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Klein and Mira Fine are the James Beard Award-winning creators of theperennialplate.com. Check out their Italy video and my recipe for farmer's market pasta on the website, splendidtable.org. Now for the compelling puzzle of our time. How did the seemingly most unfamiliar of foods, that's raw fish and rice rolled up in seaweed, end up in the convenience store next to the donuts? And how come it sells just as fast? So how did sushi, of all things, become so mainstream? And what happened to the old revered ways of making it? Well, Trevor Corson has spent years studying the hows, the whys, and the wheres of sushi. He's the author of The Story of Sushi. Chef Patty Hinnage recently talked with Trevor.
Trevor, so nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
The first thing that I want to ask you, you know, you can get a tray of sushi in a gas station these days just as you would a box of donuts. Why has sushi gone mainstream? I mean, so mainstream.
Well, this is the hilarious mystery of how this insanely exotic meal of raw fish has become like as common as McDonald's in the U.S. It's really like an all-American meal now. It just seems to have happened with no one noticing. And part of it is, I think, that, you know, starting even in the late 70s, people's awareness of the healthfulness of the food they were eating, you mm-hmm. know, became more pronounced. And so fish and grains were even recommended in 1977. Mm-hmm. And that was about the same time sushi entered into our American palate. The sad thing is that, like, our sushi has become this mix of stuff where we put in, you know, spicy chili pepper and mayonnaise and all mm-hmm. this other things that prevent you actually from tasting the fish, you know, and all the extra wasabi and everything. So it's a bit ironic and a bit of a shame that we're eating so much fish, and yet we're not really paying any attention anymore to the taste of the fish. Mm-hmm. It's more about that sort of melt-in-your-mouth succulence and all the sauces and everything. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to try more traditional sushi just so they can taste the fish again.
Absolutely. And does it matter, in your view, who is making the sushi? I mean, I just see most of the times Latins, mostly Mexicans, who I can chat with when they're giving me sushi at sushi bars. Does ethnicity matter on authenticity?
Actually, there was a survey I looked at in the course of researching my book that revealed that the percentage of Latino workers in sushi restaurants was climbing dramatically, and so they're really a strong presence. Certainly sushi that we're eating now today actually has been changed in a somewhat Latin direction because of the influence of the chef Nobu Matsuhisa, who mm-hmm. has this, you know, worldwide restaurant chain now. And he started mixing in types of food preparation he had seen in Peru, where he used to work. But as far as the ethnicities of the chef is concerned, it's ironic, but I've found that sometimes a Japanese chef won't necessarily make the effort to try to communicate what's the authentic traditions of the sushi cuisine to American customers, because they kind of figure, you know, we're Americans, we're not going to get it. Whereas I've met some wonderful sushi chefs of varying ethnicities in the United States, including Caucasian, Latino, and even one of my favorite sushi chefs is an African-American woman in Memphis, and her name is Marissa Baggett. All of these chefs I'm talking about have really made this tradition their own, and they are so excited to share the authentic traditions that they've mastered with their customers. So in a way, you can often get a more authentic experience from one of those chefs who really is teaching you about where sushi came from as they serve you.
Right. Speaking of women, I haven't seen many sushi chefs that are women behind the counter.
Yeah, this is goes back to the kind of patriarchy that is so persistent in Japanese society, and it's really hard for women to enter, you know, the sushi profession in Japan. And there are all these ridiculously stupid reasons that are given for it, like their hands are too hot and they're going to cook the fish or something.
Usually women's hands are colder, right?
Yeah.
At least mine are cold.
I found a scientific study that proved that actually men's hands are warm. So it's very challenging for them, but I think they have a better chance outside Japan right now than they do in Japan. But that may change. Let's hope so.
Trevor, I'm one of those people that has never mastered chopsticks, just don't have the patience. I always eat sushi with my fingers. What's the etiquette?
Oh, well, you are so much in luck because the best way, I think, to eat sushi is with your fingers. And there's actually a very specific reason for that. When you sit at the sushi bar and the chef makes you what's called a nigiri, that's the little like finger of rice with a slice of something on top, the traditional form, they're meant to be actually quite loose. Not packed too tightly, and they fall apart in your mouth that way. So the chef is actually, they go through these years of training to achieve the perfect amount of pressure with their fingers when they squeeze it. So just enough so the perimeter of the rice grains sticks together, but the inside of the rice pack is still kind of loose and airy. And you want that to be loose and airy. So when you put it in your mouth, the rice grains fall apart and mingle with the fish on your tongue. And most sushi diners in the U.S. have never experienced a properly made nigiri because we all think we're supposed to use chopsticks, mm-hmm. and so the chefs are all packing the sushi much too tightly so that it won't fall apart when we try to pick it up with chopsticks.
And what are we supposed to do with that wasabi? Are we supposed to mix it with the soy sauce, use it whenever we feel like it?
Well, here's the cruel truth, which is we're always served extra wasabi on the side. And even at lower-end sushi restaurants in Japan, this is the case. But it's not supposed to be there. And I have, after I've gotten to know sushi chefs and chatting with them in Japanese and everything, they finally kind of loosen up and tell me the truth, which is that when they see us mixing wasabi into our soy sauce, extra wasabi, they mm-hmm. stop giving us their best fish because we're not going to be able to taste the difference with all the spiciness in there. They're going to save the best fish for somebody else. And a good sushi chef is actually putting a little bit of wasabi into the sushi, piece of sushi, when he makes it. And he's actually calibrating the amount of wasabi to that particular fish. And there shouldn't be any more or any less. And any more is usually going to overwhelm the very delicate flavors of some of these fish. So my recommendation is tell the chef, sit at the bar, tell mm-hmm. the chef that you're not going to add extra wasabi. Could he please season the sushi for you the way he wants to, and you'll just eat it like that. And that can include even a lot of chefs, a good chef will paint a little sheen of sauce with a brush across the top of the piece of sushi and maybe a little garnish and give it to you. You don't have to do anything else to it. That's the ideal way to eat sushi. Just put it right in your mouth.
Trevor, and that was my last question. I've seen sushi chefs brush that magic sauce on top of the sushi. What is in that sauce?
Yeah, here's another thing we don't know, that straight soy sauce is really too strong of a flavor for most of the delicate fish in mm-hmm. sushi. And so any sushi chef who's good is making their own house-proof sauce. It's called nikiri, N-I-K-I-R-I. And this is a proprietary mix of soy sauce, but also a few other things, usually some dashi broth, which mm-hmm. is made from simmered kelp and fish flakes, maybe some sake, maybe a secret ingredient. It calms down the soy sauce and makes it less intense, less salty, and more complex. And that's actually a much better match, and you only need a little bit of it. And if you notice, some chefs cut little notches or nicks in the top of the fish yeah. before they put it on the rice, and that's actually another calibration of flavor. They're doing that to hold more or less sauce on top of the nigiri before they hand it to you.
Wow, truly an art form. Trevor, the next time I see you, I hope you will be eating sushi.
I hope so, too. And then after that, a tour of Mexico.
Perfect. We're on. Thank you so much, Trevor. It's been a pleasure.
Great talking with you, Patty.
Trevor Corson is an occasional sushi concierge and author of The Story of Sushi. Patty Hinnich is author of Patty's Mexican Table. Now, for a prelude to your sushi, try Shiso Crab Cocktail from Chef Jerry Traunfeld. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Why don't you talk to me? Are connecting with you, give us a call, 800-537-5252. Connect up with us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email at splendidtable.org. Let's see, Elizabeth is calling from Redondo Beach, California. Elizabeth, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for taking my question.
You are welcome. What is your question?
My question has to do with vegetable pulp. So I juice a lot of my vegetables,
right,
maybe once a week or once every other week.
Mm-hmm.
My juicer produces a nice dry vegetable pulp. So I generally juice kale and carrots, but sometimes I'll throw in like an apple or two.
Right.
And up until this point, I've been throwing it away or composting it.
Well, that's a great way to use it. It's a great
way
to use it.
Yeah, I was wondering if you have any ideas for how I could possibly repurpose it in my kitchen and maybe use it like in a salsa or a sauce or something like that.
Have you thought about carrot cake?
I hadn't thought about carrot cake.
Think about carrot cake. Take some, you know, when you do carrots, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or anything mild, like zucchini, because, you know, there's zucchini cake, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can take that pulp. And whatever measurement there is for carrots or zucchini in a zucchini bread or a carrot cake, about a third to a half of it could be that pulp, and the rest of it could be, you know, the whole carrot that you shred or do whatever to. And that's one of the ways you can use it. And you could stick the pulp in the freezer for when you're going to do this stuff.
And that sounds great.
Yeah, and you'll get all of this great flavor. And I'm not sure about doing the kale and that kind of thing, but there's got to be a place for that. Are the fibers very tough on the kale?
No, typically I will devein the kale. So, I'll put in the nice leafy greens by themselves,
right,
and then
right.
I'll put in the tougher fibers by themselves. So I can get, you know, a pulp that's softer.
Because what I'm thinking is, why not brown some onions with some garlic and throw the pulp from everything, not the stuff that's going to be stringy. But throw that into the pot and add some vegetable broth, and you're off and running. You could even puree it and add tomato and chop fresh vegetables and whatever and sort of do a version of gazpacho. You know, a little fresh lime and, you know, if you want to, some sherry vinegar and a little bit of, you know, cucumber and whatever. You see where I'm going? I mean, but especially if you cook it.
Right, right.
If you cook it, and then you could serve the soup cold, and you can do anything with that soup. It could have ginger in it. It could have, you know, something like, you know, sweet paprika with cinnamon and allspice. And you puree it, you know, so that there's no stringy sense
from
it.
Right, right.
And if you wanted to add a little yogurt to it just before you serve it cold. Oh, that would be fabulous.
Wow, it sounds delicious. You're making me hungry.
Yeah, so don't throw it away.
All right, thank you so much, Lynn. I very much appreciate it, and I have a lot of ways to go now.
Take care, Elizabeth. Enjoy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. We're going to be back with more of your calls, tweets, and other missives. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're back with your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And, of course, there's always email. Go to splendidtable.org. Barry's calling from Kankakee, Illinois. So, Barry, what's up? What's on your mind?
Well, hi, Lynn. This is really a pleasure. Nice talking with you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I hope you're doing well today.
I am doing brilliantly today.
Super duper. Well, I tell you, I'm a relative newbie listening to the show. Probably goes back to the late winter. And one of the things that I've talked with my wife about now that I'm done with my doctorate work is have some free time. And
boy, that must feel good.
Oh, I can't begin to tell you.
I can understand.
Oh,
totally.
It really does. as much not only cooking with my wife, but for her, because she has put up with a lot with me being gone so often and so forth. But I remember however long ago it was, you had a caller talking about, I think she was with a cooking club, and maybe once a month they would get together and they would have a meal around a theme.
And right. Yeah, I think I remember, you know, this is being done a lot, and I'm not sure if I remember that call, but these conversations, we've had several of them over the years.
Yeah, and that really inspired me that I wanted to do something like that, maybe once a week, maybe start a trend. Dinner and then a movie. Hey, it might catch on, right?
Well, you know, you never know.
But our cookware and our cutlery, I think, go back to the Truman administration. And so I'm looking for some thoughts for upgrading. So I am all ears.
Well, let's look at, I'll tell you one thing I would invest in because I use it all the time. And you've probably heard me mention it ad nauseum. A straight-sided 12-inch sauté pan.
Okay.
And the idea is you want a stainless steel interior. You want a thick aluminum exterior. That aluminum may be covered with black something or whatever. You don't need copper. Okay. Forget the copper. And you want that thick aluminum is going to be the thing that actually holds the heat.
Okay.
And it must come all the way up the sides of the pan. None of this business of just something thick as a heat conductor as a plaque at the bottom of the pan, because you get burnt edges around that bottom rim. And that may be well over $100. Mm-hmm. And it should be something that's comfortable in your hand. And because it's a big baby, I mean, I think mine's really more like 13 inches. Mine happens to be an all-clad, but there are other brands that are excellent. You want a long handle, and then you want an opposing, what they call a bale handle, so that you're not just lifting this large, unwieldy pan with that one long handle, because it'll twist in your hand. Okay, that's one big investment. That's where you're going to saute. That's where you can use that as a fabulous roasting pan in the oven. It is. I do sauces in it. I do stews in it. I do everything in it. And I cook for two, and I cook for eight.
All right.
The other thing that's great to have is a four-quart saucepan, because that is something that you're going to use for a lot of things, making a batch of rice, that kind of thing. And then you want something like an 8 or 10 quart pot. And this can be something you find at a discount store. This is the pot for cooking the chili, making the pasta, doing the broth, that sort of thing. And I found one that had an insert of a colander for pasta, and I use it when I make soup, too. And I want the 8 or 10 quart, because usually these pots are 6 quarts, and when you get that insert into it, you're really cooking in pasta and that kind of thing in a very small amount of water.
Sure.
So you want the big baby. And it's so great when you want to make broth or that kind of thing, because you throw all the bones and the meat into the colander, and it's so easy to just lift it out once it's done.
Sure, makes sense.
So those are basics. The other thing is, I don't mean to tout us, but on the Splendid Tables store, which is connected with Amazon, we have some great bargain knives. You want a really good long paring knife, about a 4-inch paring knife. You want about an 8-inch chef's knife. You know, that's the triangular blade. And there are knives out there that are like $20 or $30. And then you're going to see some information on knife sharpeners. And there's a nifty little one that's $14, would you believe?
All right.
And it really does a good job. And it's small. It's easy to handle. You can stick it in your pocket, for goodness sakes, if you're prone to sharpening knives while you're traveling. So there's your basic. The other thing is, for roasting things or baking, I like a big half sheet pan. And these run about $18. And they're usually like 17 by whatever. They should fit in your oven. And they're called half sheet pans. So if you go online and you look around, you'll see them.
Okay.
You know, that's what they're called. And the great thing is, they're shallow. So this is what I do, roasted vegetables. And wherever I need a lot of space for stuff to spread out, when I flip it over, I have a cookie sheet.
Oh, nice.
So the back of it becomes a cookie sheet.
Great.
And there is your basic kitchen to start out with.
This has been very helpful.
I'm so glad. And congratulations, and may you two have just a lovely time cooking together.
We shall.
Okay.
Nice talking with you. Take care, please.
You too, Barry.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You know, it's interesting, because some of these things, like, you know, a $28 knife, people say, oh, how good could it be? With the technology we have today with knives, it can be very good indeed. Shelley's on the line from Harold, California. Shelley, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. It's wonderful to talk to you. You and I have spent many a road mile together. part of my work takes me in all over California. And
what do you
my
do?
Sunday evening, I'm ready for you. Now, I'm a equine portrait photographer. I photograph horses on ranches with their families.
Oh, really? How incredible.
That comes after about 400 weddings and things like that. I graduated to doing something I wanted to do.
I don't know. I like people, but horses are just magnificent.
Aren't they? Oh, I have 9 of them.
You do?
Yes.
What kind? I mean, is there a particular breed you're
All
into?
All kinds. We have a horse ranch where we do riding lessons, and I think we have one of everything.
You know, that was my dream as a kid.
Really?
Oh, I loved horses, and I would ride anything. I mean, I would go bicycling as a little kid and find a horse in a pasture.
And you put the rope across the handlebars and pretend there were reins?
Oh, yes, but I also would put the rope across the horse's neck and ride it.
Oh,
there were farmers who got very upset. Really upset.
Well, you will have to come and visit.
But did you have a question, Shelley?
I do. You know, I'm not much of a cook, and my mother and sister published a cookbook years ago, and all they wanted me to do was the photography. So
what a bummer.
I know. But our latest passion is that we have just opened a little B&B on the ranch.
Oh, that's great.
I know. It's wonderful. Can I say the name of the ranch?
Yeah.
Okay. It's Slice of Heaven Ranch.
Okay. All right.
You can find it. Anyway, I have been serving fresh ranch eggs and the fruit from the property, but I don't have enough customers to use up all the fruit, and I've got an overabundance of figs that are all different stages of ripening. Some are practically jam, and some are very firm.
Right.
And then I've got Asian pears, apples, and pomegranates.
Wow.
And I've been peeling and quartering the pears and serving them with cream in the morning.
Mm.
But what do I do with all the rest of the figs?
Do you want to take a shot at preserving?
Okay, what about freezing?
Well, there is freezing, but the only problem with freezing fruit is it breaks down.
Okay.
And that's fine. You can do very simple kind of preserves. You can flavor them. You can spice them. You know, you could throw in vinegar. In so many words, that fruit can become the quote-unquote chutney. It can become the preserve. It can become the sauce. And then that can all go into freezer bags.
Okay. So is there a recipe somewhere?
Well, you can take any preserving book, all right, that have interesting sounding recipes and know that you can cook them exactly the way it's described, but you don't have to can them. You can freeze them.
Okay.
Now, there is a new book out called Saving the Season by Kevin West, which is excellent. There is the Blue Chair Jam cookbook or preserving cookbook.
Okay.
Now, I'm saying look at these recipes. They're not going to be to the letter because they're going to maybe have you cooking the fruit longer. They may have you adding more sugar than you want to add. So you're going to go by taste.
Okay.
But they are going to give you the basic roadmap.
Okay. What about Asian pears? What can I,
oh,
what
boy,
can I
they're
do with
so
them? Either
crisp.
Either currently without, you know, just making something.
You know, I wonder, I have never done this, but I just wonder about something.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if you took some good rum, clear rum, though, and some sugar, mm-hmm. vanilla beans, some black peppercorns.
Okay.
And you made a syrup out of that. So you do, I'd say, one part sugar to two-thirds part rum.
Two-thirds part rum.
Right. So let's say you had one cup of sugar, two-thirds cup of rum, all right, because the sugar is going to help you preserve.
Mm-hmm.
And you put in about a tablespoon of vanilla.
Mm-hmm.
And you put in about 10 black peppercorns that you lightly bruised. You'd simmer that until it's clear. And if you want to add water to that, you could. But the alcohol is going to help with the preserving.
Oh.
Okay? And then you cut up in whatever shape you want those pears. You stuff the pears into a sterile jar. And then you pour that hot syrup over it until it's completely covered.
Oh, my.
And you'll get sort of a brandied fruit kind of thing.
Ooh.
The more alcohol you have in there, the better the preserving. Okay?
And so can you take that out later and use it like in a pie? Or?
Absolutely. But the other thing is you can take it out later, use the syrup over the fruit or
anything.
The pancakes, right? And then, you know, chunks of the fruit on the side.
Oh, awesome. Thank
and, you know, one of the great things is I had a wonderful, just a simple, delicious green salad from the garden kind of thing that someone did. And they took Asian pears and they sliced all the way across the pear. So you just had a big ring.
Mm-hmm.
And they sliced it very thin, and they just stood them up in the salad. It was unbelievable. Just oil, vinegar, salad, and the Asian pears. Now, that you're going to have to eat a lot of that to get through your Asian pears, but I throw it out as a thought.
Sure. Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you so
I
much.
I hope this helps, Shelley, because I know what you mean when you say, I need a roadmap.
I do.
No, but I'm
do.
Like that with, not with food, but I'm like that with a lot of other things.
And if you're ever in Northern California, you have to come and stay with us. You would love it. We have baby goats and horses, and you'd have a ball.
Oh, if I could just take care of a horse for a day. I'll even shovel out the barns, believe it or not. I miss it a
okay,
lot.
Okay, you're booked.
Okay.
You're booked.
Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Seriously, I would do that. 800-537-5252. At something like 5 years old, Ben Sargent was demanding shrimp for breakfast. For every breakfast. And he stood a fair chance of getting it since he did grow up on the New England coast in a family where seafood was a way of life. Well, eventually that heritage led to a popular seafood restaurant in Brooklyn. And then an odd turn of events made him the lobster roll king of New York's underground food movement. In Ben Sargent's case, the underground was literal. Well, now he's written a cookbook, The Catch. Ben, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you had a real restaurant, and essentially you kind of walked away from that and ended up in a basement. And I'd like to, if you could tell us what in heaven's name that was about.
Sure. When I moved to Williamsburg, it was not as nice as it is now. And I had this idea that I wanted to sell surfboards and my grandfather's chowders and have essentially a very fishy menu, which is not a problem nowadays. Back then, it was, you know, it's expensive to make chowders, and people weren't ready to pay that price, nor were they ready for lobster rolls. So I ultimately, after doing two restaurants, came back to just doing it out of my apartment. I was so frustrated with the lobster rolls that were being, you know, talked about in New York City. They were just wrong. They were too fancy. And so I started making them in my basement apartment, and word got out, and suddenly I had all these lobster-craving fanatics who I only knew through way of, because it was all through cell phone that people would get a hold of me.
Right.
I would see their number come through, and I had a nickname too, it was Dr. Claw, and they would say, Dr. Claw, hook it up, I'm on the corner of Lormer and whatever. And I would see a 508 area code come through, so I knew it was a New Englander. I'd be like, oh, here we go, this guy knows his lobster roll. So.
And you would, did they come to you, or did you go to them?
Well, at first they came to me, and I was having like these small little servings in my basement apartment. But then I actually got busted by the fire department because I had so much propane that I could probably have blown up the building times two. My landlord actually didn't know what was going on, and he lives above me. So we had a very awkward conversation where I told him I was running this illegal lobster roll business out of his basement. And he actually didn't say to stop. What he said to stop doing was to have, you know, he didn't want people coming down to dine there. But he was happy enough to have me continue cooking illegally. So I had to move the operation out onto the street. And that's actually where the whole sort of, I don't know if I can say it on the radio, but the sort of drug dealing persona came from. And so people would hit me in the street with a $20 bill rolled up, you know, and it was a secret handshake, and off they would.
Yeah, but you gained quite a name in New York City. I mean, these lobster rolls were knocking people out. And, you know, we're in this lobster roll period where across the country, not just on the coast, lobster roll joints are opening up. So I figure you're from New England, you're obsessed. What is a great lobster roll?
Okay, so you really want to get me going on this one?
Yeah.
Is this a two-hour interview? I hope so. Simplicity is key. And I will also say some not-so-popular things like high fructose corn syrup is also key. Your bun has to be very sweet. I go with a Pepperidge Farm over the J.J. Nissen.
Uh-huh.
I'm a believer of toasting on the inside, not on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I use just a little bit of garlic and a splash of wine in my butter concoction. I am a huge believer in not wringing out your lobster. After you've steamed your lobster, you have to hold on, preserve all those juices, because you're going to later sort of build up a little, almost like a little bit of a sauce with the mayonnaise. But the trick is that the mayonnaise is not going to be the overpowering ingredient. The lobster and its juices, its extract, is what's going to really flavor it. And the other thing is proportions, because it has to dissolve in your mouth in that crunchy, amazing bite. But I also think that if you overload your lobster roll, you might impress people, but you're not getting the proportions that are right, because you have to be able to lift it in your hand and take that bite. So I see them in the city spilling over with all these horrific garnishes and lettuce in there and bits and pieces, and I'm like, that's wrong, because you have to eat it with a fork. And then if you put celery anywhere near a lobster roll, you've automatically destroyed it, because now it tastes like celery and not lobster. And I also am a believer in, you know, you have to steam your lobster. I build up a little concoction so it tastes like the sea when I dip my finger in there.
Uh-huh.
An inch of salt water with some seaweed in there, or if you don't have seaweed, I throw an onion in, garlic, salt, and a little bit of pepper. And that's it.
And then you steam over that.
And then I steam it. And then I take the lobster out a little bit on the raw side, because what I do is I like to throw it for a few, just a minute, on the skillet. Not to bring it up to, like, you know, piping hot,
yeah,
sort of a medium, so that it's just above room temperature, because that's really when the flavor is released. And that's it. And I think at first most people are actually sort of bummed out when they first see what a lobster roll is, because they think it's going to be this high cuisine, Asian something, you know, I don't know. And then they see that it's in this nasty New England hot dog, and it's just all stuffed in there. They have a whole different idea of what they're about to get. But everyone will agree with me who likes lobster that it is one of the most unbelievable bites on earth, like something you will remember for the rest of your life.
I have to agree. I mean, I've been there and done that, and I will do it again as often as I can.
Yeah.
Ben, thank you for talking with us.
Absolutely.
Ben Sargent is author of The Catch, Sea to Table Recipes, Stories, and Secrets. And that infamous Dr. Claus lobster roll recipe, well, that's now on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this paraphrase of an Oscar Wilde observation. After a good lobster, one can forgive anyone, even one's family. Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to our website to get information on anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all there for you, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.